Welcome to Grounding Grief, a podcast dedicated to talking about grief. I'm Ann Beach, your host. If you like this podcast, follow us, write a review, or email me with your thoughts at ann@groundinggrief.com. The messiness of grief, muddled thinking, at times feeling stuck as if wandering about aimlessly in a fog. These descriptions typically resonate with people in the early days of grief. Later on, the timelessness of it emerges, the understanding that grief endures as a silent companion. The past couple of weeks, I have been in a muddle. It's taken a bit for me to pinpoint how I have been feeling, to give it a name, but muddle it is. When asked how I'm doing, to certain people, I have been answering, in a muddle. Even without the obvious follow-up question of why, I have been pondering the why. I sensed it might involve grief. Still, I couldn't sort through the messiness of my thinking to get beyond my confusion and contradictory thoughts to find words and explain why. During this period of muddle thinking, I have spent a fair amount of time thinking about end of life and the decisions faced by the dying and those who love them when death can be anticipated because of old age or a long-term illness. I started thinking about this after my friend Vicky's mother died. That was recently, and she died in Vicky's home, with Vicky being her caregiver. I had visited Vicky a week before she died, and before I left, I peeked in on the tiny woman with the labored breathing, hooked up to oxygen as she slept. I knew then that would probably be the last time I'd see her alive. My experiences with death have taught me to text the newly grieving, asking specifically if a visit is in order now, or would coffee tomorrow work, ending with, "I'll make certain to text you before I meet you." I know how changeable moods and energy are in grief. Those days shortly after someone you have loved has died are the quiet ones, when everyone else has gone back to the rhythm of their lives, their beat unchanged. The griever, however, can find no rhythm. Old patterns are so disrupted as you feel the power of the void left by the absence, the forever absence, of that person you loved so dearly. Their absence, followed by this quiet, elicits muddled thinking. Thoughts float, attaching to emotions, so at times the quiet is so very welcome as you try to process the feelings, to find words to express them to others when they inquire, "How are you?" Other times, the quiet brings about a disquiet, and then the presence of others, people who will listen as you try to sort out the muddle, is just what you crave. Yet you hesitate to reach out, for you know all those who offered to do anything, anytime, just call me, have busy lives, and any hesitation from them to be available will feel like a rejection. And that is something you cannot bear when feeling so raw and vulnerable and alone. So when I reach out to someone in grief, especially during those early quiet days, I do so with specifics. That allows the griever to answer yes or no, or to say thank you, not today, or perhaps offer a different time, and sometimes even say, "Yes, please come." That is how, a couple of days after Vicky's mother's funeral, I was sitting at her table talking to her about all sorts of things, including her recent loss and death. Vicky and I are comfortable talking about these things together. She's the same Vicky who recorded the suicide and accepting gifts episodes with me. I suspect my thoughts on end of life and how best to handle it when you have the luxury of planning it in the case of the sick or elderly were all in a muddle when I was talking that day. During our conversation, I told her how much I admired and respected her for allowing both her mother and her father a few years earlier to die in her home. She responded that she couldn't imagine anything different. It was natural for her to adopt the role of caregiver with all its disruptions and difficult demands. I commented on how I suspected, given a choice, we'd all rather die at home or in the home of a loved one, but it seemed to me our culture encouraged institutionalization at life's end, be it in a hospital or a long-term care facility. Even as I said this to Vicky, I also thought about how I'd not want my children or their lives overtaken by my needs, needs for which they would have little or no training and for which they would get minimal professional support were I to become infirm. After I left Vicky, I thought about what I'd said and wondered whether people who opt to institutionalize loved ones might face a more complicated grief out of guilt. And before delving into my thinking about guilt and grief, I did a little research on current trends of where people in the United States die. The most recent data from the Centers for Disease Control confirm a trend toward an increasing percentage of people dying at home. In fact, of the three categories of places people die, at home, in a hospital, or in a long-term care facility, in-home deaths presently have the highest percentage. Nonetheless, when the categories of hospital and long-term care facility deaths are combined, they total double the percentage of deaths in homes. Unbeknownst to Vicky when we talked, I was thinking about all of this because my father is dying, and he will die in a long-term care facility, having recently been moved there from the memory care unit he entered slightly more than 2 years ago. I questioned myself long and hard, would I, on his death, in addition to grief, compound it with feelings of guilt? I'm fairly certain I will not, and all I face now is the anticipatory grief of his impending death, and that most of all, when he dies, I will feel a sense of relief for him. While I explored these thoughts, at times I was very sad, others contemplative. Mostly, my thinking led me to feeling grateful for the relationship between my dad and his second wife of 38 years. My dad remarried 9 months before my wedding, and she has given him such joy, followed by loving care throughout the years together, especially since he was diagnosed with Alzheimer's several years ago. My dad hasn't known who I am for almost a decade. During their marriage, Dad and his wife built a contented, joyful, loving existence many states away from my siblings and me. At any stage of his disease, moving Dad away from his devoted wife would have been cruel. Her care has always been competent, insightful, and loving. He maintained his dignity despite being afflicted by a disease that does all it can to rob someone of their dignity, and I credit her for that. She kept him at home with her as long as it was safe for both of them, even a tad longer than I was comfortable with. Though young and spry for her age, she wisely realized a couple of years ago that things could get pretty ugly if, while caring for him, something happened to her. And so, with our blessing and support, he was moved to a memory care unit in January of 2022. 3 weeks ago, Dad had to be moved to an end-of-life facility that provided a higher level of care. Once again, his wife took on the tasks of finding someplace for him. She has, as she has all along, spared my siblings and me the caregiver role and asked very little in return other than our blessing. Although he rarely awakens now, I'm told he smiles at the videos of his great-grandchildren we send her way. He was, and is, happy to this day, and she gave that to us and him. As the timing of circumstances in my life had Vicky's mother's in-home death juxtaposed with my father's impending death and his being moved from one institution to another, I now understand the reasons for my muddled thinking, my confusion. Where I stand today is surrounded by the anticipatory grief of knowing that when the second of my parents dies, my siblings and I will become the oldest living generation in our families. I know also that upon his death, the anticipatory grief will be replaced by my old familiar friend, grief. And as prepared as I may think I am for it, it will be full of twists and turns and surprises. I will experience the entire range of emotions that visited me upon the deaths of various friends and relatives, but most especially the death of my grandmother, my sister, and my daughter. The complexity of emotions I felt then and waded through will at times pull me under, and then I will rise to the surface to sit quietly and remember them, our times together, as tears well up into my eyes. I know also that sitting right beside the sadness and sorrow and grief will be gratitude. Gratitude for my courage in muddling through these thoughts to face them a bit before the roller coaster ride of full-on grief hits me. And there will be gratitude for the honest and difficult conversations we held among family members that led to unity on what is and has been kindest, safest, and best for Dad. Most of all, through and in my grief, I will remember Dad with these thoughts of gratitude. Thank you for my education, all the long walks whenever we were together, for the innumerable day trips to see me and your grandchildren, the numerous fields you stood on uncomplainingly as you watched them play any number of sports, even though you would have preferred reading quietly someplace by yourself, and for North Lake. It is, as you always called it, paradise. If you find at the end of your journey there is something, may it be that you are greeted by your cherished brother George, who died in 1946, your mother, whom we called Nanny, who died in your arms on your birthday 30 years ago, your daughter, my sister Ellen, and my dear Victoria, who you remembered long after you forgot me. I know how deeply you felt her loss, and that meant so very much to me. I hope they greet you with their sparkling eyes and brilliant smiles, but if not, and it is as you believed, there is nothing. May the quiet nothingness enfold you and allow you to rest in peace, dear Dad. Love, Annie. Thank you for listening to this episode of Grounding Grief.